Blog Talk Radio.
Rid of legal, overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounds that system of segregation. The sense system of struggle.
When the world must come together as one, there are people dying. Oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life, the greatest gift of all. We keep on pretending day by day that the moon somewhere we can make a change. We all are part of God's great big family, and the truth, you know, love is all we need. So they know that someone cares, and their hearts will be stronger and free. As God has shown us, fight, turn our strong breath, and so we all must lend a helping hand. We are the world, we are the children, we
Just you.
white, that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than white. As we look at these problems, we see.
This is Bible class night, and we got Sister Mary reading the 23rd number of Psalms. Mary, you on? Mary, you on?
Yes.
Okay, read the 23rd number of Psalms for us, and we're going to get on with our program.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He making me to lie down in green pastures. He leading me beside the still waters. He restored my soul. He leading me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, do I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou prepares a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anoints my head with oil, my cup running over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that reading, Mary, 23rd number 5, the Lord is my shepherd. Sometimes we thank you for that 23rd number, the Lord is my shepherd. John, this is Bible class tonight, and I want to talk about some of the things that are happening in our world, in our spiritual world. What happened to us spiritually, and we are caught up with a loss of evil in our life, and we have to be able to be consistent for things to work in our life. But one thing we're talking about tonight in the Bible, that you got your Bible, the 23rd of the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. So God is our protector. And he have God. And we can't get around what God will do for us, and God will guide us. And sometimes we have to look beyond and ask the question, what is my assignment on earth? What should I be doing in 2022? Should I live? Should I die? For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believe in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. I mean, you get ready, you embrace God. I'm praying for those that call me and those that need help. Some of the people that need help, you don't know they're in your neighborhood, part of your family. But tonight, I remember Dr. Abernathy talking about when he was with Dr. King, and he had to go to surgery, and he made it. When God is with you, God will guide you. And he said, fret not thyself for evildoers, they'll soon be cut down. And what that means, they'll waste away. You know, things that I learned from that lesson, God always gets you ready for what's going to happen. Body, mind, soul, and spirit. Sometimes you feel like I'm all alone. But I want you to know, when you read the 23rd of the Lord is my shepherd, I should not want you to bring a scenario to the table. You bring the power of God and the angels. Muriel is the angel of this month, along with Michael and Gabriel. And when God called Enoch up, Enoch did not die. He didn't taste death. He just walked with God. And the old theologians say he walking with God. He got halfway. And God told him, come on, just go with me. So Enoch went up to heaven. And Enoch seen what's going on today. He seen about the fallen angels, the 200 fallen angels. And they was locked up. God took care of them. Their wings was clipped where they couldn't come back in the heavenly realm. Revelation chapter 12, verse 7, Michael and his angel had walked up in heaven. And Michael and his angel did run the 200 angels out of the heaven realm. They came into the physical realm. And being in the physical realm, they messed up. You know, you read about all that they did. But God left us on the earth to be able to endure what's going on. And you have to understand, God has never made a mistake. So what you want God to do tonight, the word will come that God will bless you. And God will take you to the next level. You're saying, well, Bishop, where we go from here? Nothing but the word of God will keep us. How long? Not long. See, when you understand that God will carry you to another level in your life, get your Bible. You need to have it because anytime we might break out and give you some scriptures. And the scripture we will give you will be healing body, mind, soul, and spirit. And as the word God give it to me, there's a message in the word. I want to say tonight, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And some of you been having storms in your life. And you've been wondering, how can I overcome the storm in my life? How can I overcome the sickness in my life? I've been asking, but ain't nobody told me how I should overcome what's going on in my life. If anybody told you how to overcome in your life, so you left looking for results. You left looking for answers. And you lost for words. And when John Henry Clark, Dr. Clark, was speaking, I think he was speaking in August 9th, 1990, about what's happening to us as a race of people. And he was talking about the action of some of us. So sometimes we listen and we read. We get the knowledge, but we don't do nothing with the knowledge. You got to be able to do something with the knowledge for the knowledge to work for you. I'm praying tonight for every letter, every telephone call. I'm praying for you, Brother Robert, for the reading of the 23rd number of Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd. If you don't read nothing else tonight, read the 23rd number of Psalm. For energy. Read it for strength.
Marcus Garvey in the Caribbean islands, which made the emphasis on Jamaica. then you can see how it was logical for a Marcus Garvey to emerge. In an hour where color consciousness was a prevailing thing, how did this jet black man emerge with no color consciousness toward himself, with no apology for his being? Because he looked back at the revolutionary heritage of the island that gave him birth, in the revolutionary heritage of the Caribbean islands itself. It had the most successful slave revolt of any African people outside of Africa. Successful because they maintained an African culture continuity until they suddenly decided in the middle of the 19th century that they were going to become black English and black Dutch and black French and black every damn thing except Africa. But until that point, there were people using their African culture continuity in revolt and holding themselves together based on this culture continuity. Now, let's look at the roots of this culture continuity and the roots of the emergence of the Marcus Garvey and why his emergence in the Caribbean islands is absolutely logical. Then we have to think at the end of it, because if Marcus Garvey was walking down the street of Jamaica right now with the same idea, with the same program of this change to make it for stone to death. It is so un-Garvey at this point. It is so far from Garvey. Now, they kill it because they have bargained their African culture continuity and their African self to be those things most unlike themselves. Now, Marcus Garvey, born 1887. And let's look at what was happening. 1787 in those hours. The Maroon revolts were already in motion and had not only flourished in Jamaica, it had flourished throughout the Caribbean islands. The so-called Bush Negro revolts had already occurred in Suriname. The Baptist revolt in Guyana had already occurred. The Haitian Maroons were already on the march. And the Haitian Maroons were on the march the same time as the Jamaican Maroons, although the Jamaican Maroons are the best known. There were Maroons throughout the hemisphere, including the United States. Now, in this period of resistance to slavery, something was happening on this island. 1830, in fact, about, the British went through the motion of emancipating their slaves. It was a motion only. Now, while the slave was emancipated, he had to go back and work on the same plantation where he had been a slave because no other employment was open to him. Now he must take care of his wife, his children, his housing, his clothing for a pittance. So the new freedom was less secure than the old slavery. By 1865, the Jamaicans began to discover that the emancipation was a fake. This is why it is nonsense when And Calvin Fudd said, our freedom came before your emancipation. All you're saying is that your fakery came 30 years before our fakery, in as much as. Inasmuch as neither one of us are emancipated to this day, because emancipation is nothing that someone can do for you. It is something either you do for yourself or it is not real. Freedom is something you take with your own hands. You secure it with your own hand. No generation leaves it for another generation. Each generation in its own way, even if it inherits freedom, must secure that freedom all over again with its own strength, its own will, its own hand. And when you forget that and become lax, you have freedom. No more. All right. 1850 in the Caribbean Islands. The British, the Jamaican colors approached the British. They wanted special privileges. And they were telling the British, if you give us the special privileges, we will protect you from the blacks. And when the British were reluctant to give them special privileges, by 1865, they said, give us these privileges or we're going to join the blacks. Now, this accounts for the large number of mulattoes involved in the Moret Bay uprising in 1865. And Gordon and other mulattoes who committed themselves to that revolution. Once the British understood this, they gradually began to give these privileges. They began to create a multi-ethnic society based on color to the point where Jamaica became the most stratified society along color, caste, and economic lines in all the world. Almost as stratified as India with its multiplicity of caste. 70 different definitions of color and caste in Jamaica alone. Special jobs for different people of special gradation of color and hair texture. And this would destabilize the country to the point where the British had an internal army protecting them, and this robbed Jamaica of the privilege that went to Haiti. The Haitian revolt was set in motion by Jamaicans. Jamaicans, troublemakers, that they wanted to get rid of, so they sold them to plantations in Haiti. The Jamaican farmers sold them to plantations in Haiti, and the most noted being Volkman, who decided he's going to be a priest. But he's a priest, and he wasn't going to work on the farm. So as a priest, he began to organize the Yoruba slaves and the solidification of the Haitian Revolution to the point they moved it so fast. Tusa de Louverture had to run to catch up with the revolution in order to lead it. And yet, these that two Jamaicans left out of history that helped to set this revolution in motion, Mackendale and Bookman. And think that Jamaica forgot its revolutionary heritage. And once a people forget their revolutionary heritage, they come like beggars with an empty cup at the door of a people less than they are, only they don't know that the people are less than they are. They follow people who don't know where they are going just because the people are the color of power. Because Marcus Garvey is the center of the revolutionary black Jacob Maroons who fought. He did not grow up with all the color caste stipulations and all the color caste privileges and fear of other Jamaicans. Now you can see the mentality of Marcus Garvey emerging. You can see now where he get all the nerve and the bombast because he grew up with confidence in himself. And besides, he was a master craftsman. And being a master craftsman, mastering a trade that is needed, almost indispensable to the island, this gave him confidence and a low privilege. He was a master printer. Print, he would call stripes, he would ask for better condition. He would go down throughout Central America, asking for better condition, but studying the people. Now you can see the antecedents of Marcus Garvey before he would arrive in the United States. He would go to England. He would work. He would study. He would work on Jews Muhammad Ali's newspaper, the African Times, the Orient Review. He would read an editorial in that magazine, in that newspaper. The editorial would quote from a, of all things, a white black nationalist named Booth. Booth was a man in Nyasaland, now the country called Malawa. He had grown sick of other white missionaries, and he went through this country telling the Africans the white man cannot be trusted. And he was saying, Africa for the Africans. When finally the Africans said that you're a white man, can you be trusted? To his everlasting credit, he said, no. Marcus Garvey would read in Jews Muhammad Ali's paper the quote from Booth, said, Africa for the Africans. And Marcus Garvey would add, those at home and those abroad. One thing about Marcus Garvey, he never stole from a second rater. And he always rehashed what he took from others in such a way it became his and his own original stamp to it. Coming back to Jamaica, he was a failure again in the Jamaica of that day, as much failure he would be in the Jamaica of this day, because the revolutionary atmosphere that could protect the Marcus Garvey does not exist in Jamaica. It does not exist any place in the Caribbean island for this day. Okay, now let's come to the United States and let's look at his antecedents in the United States. My main point here is that Marcus Garvey did not announce anything new, but brought it in such a way and put it in a language that masses of people could understand. You could whistle them. You could feel it. And that his timing was so good. Now, 1787 in the United States, there had emerged in New England a small black elite, Frederick Douglass, Prince Paul, who started the Masons, called it the African Lodge. Blacks had fought in the American Revolution, began to demand a little privileges based on that. Blacks had grown tired of going into white churches and sitting on the side or up in the buzzard's roof, and they had challenged whites, and after the challenge, they found the independent black message in festival touch. They didn't toy with this word Negro or color. They didn't water it down with black. Black tells you how you look, but it don't tell you who you are. And they didn't deal with this word, bro. There is no bro in Africa. When an Italian, you ask an Italian what he said, I'm Italian American. He just said, I'm a bro. Spell it out, Italian American. So get it out of your mouth. I mean, say it straight. African. Get the word Africa all the way in there. Don't break Africa with the word pro. Leave out the pro. I'm saying that at this point in our history, we were not only longing for Africa, we were having thoughts about return 100 years before Marcus Garvey was born. The African Lodge and the early African society, the first Masonic order found by a man from Barbados, Prince Hall, Oddfellow, found by a man from Antigua, Peter Ogden. Now look what you got then that you don't have now. Caribbean people and African American people working hand in side by side. No one is calling each other any name. But they realized something then you don't realize now, that the slave ship brought no West Indians, brought no Black Americans, brought no Jamaicans. So they were all African people. They had a common interest as African people. Now, first Masonic order found by a Caribbean person, Prince Hall, another lodge found by another one, Peter Ogden. When they began the early Back to Africa movement, when Martin Delaney went out to search for a place for settlement, he went out with the Jamaican Robert Campbell, who wrote a classical account of the trip. Pilgrimage to my motherland, included in a book called Such Core Play. The lady was a Harvard man, and he issued a Harvard man's report. His English was superb. All the I's were dotted, all the T's were crossed. But if you ever get the book, make a comparison. Read Campbell's. His language is rough hue, sometimes his center structure is off, but the man's love for Africa, for returning to Africa, is pure poetry, pure commitment. Now, we're working together now, instead of calling names, making division. Our first newspaper, Freedom Journal, is edited by another Jamaican, a Jamaican mulatto, John B. Ruswam. After he finished the editing of Freedom Journal, he went out to Liberia and edited the Liberian Hall, a Herald, a paper that still didn't exist. And he was governor of one of the provinces. He didn't say, I'm a West Indian governor, I'm a Jamaican governor. He said, I'm a governor. You have to understand that this early manifestations of Pan-Africanism before it had its name, and that all of this was preparation for the ultimate emergence of a Marcus Garvey. David Walker's appeal, Nat Turner revolt, Gabriel Prosser revolt, Denmark Beese's revolt, especially David Walker's appeal to the colored people of the world to take up arms against your enemy. Oh, my God, was that it? Let's leave this place. Coming near the end of that century, a Back to Africa minister, again, a mulatto who thought that by virtue of being close to whites, he deserved some privileges. And when he discovered that his tail could be kicked just as hard as the black is black, he began to fight like the black is black. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner. He would mount an American flag in his pulpit before his sermon. Then he would point to the flag and say, this flag ain't nothing but a GD rag. And he would preach another sermon against what this country has done to its people before he started regular sermon. He started a Back to Africa movement around the same time Marcus Garvey was born. And as we came into the 20th century, we were arguing over the Booker T. Washington concept, the Du Bois concept. Africans had been revolting all over Africa. The Caribbean islands are now fighting for some form of constitutional government. England had created a model colony in Barbados. This is why they still think of themselves as Little England. All of this had happened now. Marcus Garvey would begin to emerge into consciousness around 1908. After his Central American trip, he would go to England where he would meet Jews Muhammad Ali. Now, when he returned to Jamaica and tried to find the Universal Negro Improvement Association and failed in Jamaica, he came to the United States with the hope of getting the kind of money he needed to establish a school like Tuskegee. Booker T. Washington had issued him an invitation in 1914. When he arrived in 1916, Booker T. Washington was dead, and he couldn't get along with the people Booker T. Washington left behind. He toured the United States, speaking and impressing a whole lot of people with his nerve. Now here you have to deal with something which you fail to deal with. When you grow up in a country where you are the majority, you have a different outlook on the world, though you are a slave. Marcus Garvey had a different outlook on the world. When you grow up in a country where you are the minority, well, you have to do what most black Americans still have to do. You rise each morning and petition a white person for the right to live to the end of the day. And you can say I'm wrong, but think it over. Who do you have to get a job from? And even if you own your business, who do you have to get the products from? If you're selling vegetables, who's your wholesaler? We still rise this morning, one way or the other, petition one white person or the other for the right to live to the end of the day. Marcus Garvey came to America at a time after the First World War. Blacks were returning, being put upon riots. East St. Louis, blacks just go to a gate and ask for a job and were driven away. They made bonfires and burned black children. And in Chicago, the riots were widespread. Marcus Garvey would go to Chicago and rally the blacks. They didn't need much rallying because they had freshly arrived from the South looking for jobs in Pagan House, looking for jobs in Chicago, and they've taken so much abuse in the South, they're up north, they said they wasn't going to take it. Many of them began to grease wire and put it across the street. And so when the thugs came in, that car hit the wire that stopped the car, then the black thugs would jump out and teach them a lesson. That stopped the riot. Marcus Garvey had told them, look what you see. They don't want us here. Not only let's go home to Africa, let's go home in our own ship. Now the dreamer began to dream the great dream. It was after the First World War. The Secretary of War, Newton D. Baker, had told black Americans that your lot will not be changed by such a participating in this war. And to prove this, that his point, some blacks were lynched in their uniform. We give you nothing. Blacks were not permitted in combat in the American army. Young Pershing didn't want them near the battlefield. French said that I will take all you got. And the blacks who distinguished themselves in battle distinguished themselves under French commander. The Red Cross going to the field to pick up the wounded and the dead left the blacks to die. You boys had written an editorial called Close Rank. Let's forget our differences and let this war be won. And when he went to France and saw the condition, he wanted to take it all back. Close ranks for what? Now, in this atmosphere, 1917, in the red summer of 1919, riots all over the country, burning blacks down. Now can you see why it was easy for Martha Garvey to create the atmosphere and to add to the atmosphere of return, because the country had rejected us and he was telling us that it's a land that is yours. He said the American promise wasn't made to you. The American dream wasn't dreamed for you. I will make you a new promise. I will give you a new dream. And I will give you a new land. That's out. 1920, he would call the largest convention of blacks ever. Old Madison Square Garden, turning back 30,000 people a day, and only 30,000 could fit into the auditorium. Marcus Garvey was doing more than just giving out speeches. This man, with his multifaceted of talent, presented a platform for singers, dancers, musicians. He was creating the semblance of a state. And what we have lost in the world is the idea that we once ruled a state. All our best. During the same time, he would petition Liberia, that sick nation that rejected him and would have been a better nation had they not rejected him. He petitioned them for settlement. 1920, they did not tell him then that they weren't going to permit him, because these stooges of America, who hadn't changed to this day, lied to Marcus Garvey. And someone thinks that because Du Bois had a fake position, plenipotentiary, that Du Bois had some power. Du Bois had no power. I think we need to be honest with ourselves. I think we charge Du Bois with a whole lot that he's guilty of. He said some unfortunate things about Marcus Garvey and later lived to take it back, took it back on several occasions. And he did something most of you haven't done. You haven't admitted when you were wrong. Now, Martha, Father, is in difficulty with the steamship line. The different trials, this would go on. Martha, Father, would commit some serious errors. He would dismiss his lawyer and be his own lawyer, and he would lose his own case. There's much more to it than that. In this book, there's a chapter called Trials and Triumphs of Marcus Garvey. But the trial is available in some places. You can get the complete trial. Marcus Garvey was not guilty as charged. This is why I'm against the idea of pardoning Marcus Garvey. To pardon him in the case that he was guilty, and you're asking him to forgive the guilt. I'm for the vindication of Marcus Garvey because he wasn't guilty in the first place. I'm for asking this nation to apologize for having imprisoned him. But in 1927, he was freed from Atlanta prison. While he was away, the organization did not fall apart. It became shattered into several factions. Because we are people with bruised ego. And we suffer terribly from ego starvation. We have envision an army full of generals with no private, because everybody want to be Mr. Somebody or Mrs. Somebody. We argue among ourselves, split up, and now we've got 10 heads instead of one, neither one of them achieving anything. We are the most organized, we are the most leadenest people in America. We have more leaders and less leadership than any people in this country. No centralized leadership responsible for the whole people. What would happen after the deportation of Marcus Garvey? The movement would go on in some fashion. T. Thomas Fortune, one of the great generals we have, will still continue to work for the old Negro world, the right voice. We could continue to be its editor. It will still attract some of the most able African-American minds of that day. Farris, one of the finest intellects to come out of the Garvey movement, was now in the process of its book, The Negro, The Africans Abroad, still worth reading after all these years. In the shadow of the Garvey movement, a whole literature emerged. Tony Martin, Wellesley College, who did the book Race First, have done some smaller books dealing with different aspects of Garveyism, Garvey's Pan-Africanism, literary Garveyism, Garvey as a hero. All these books need to be read. We as a people overhear conversations and sometimes with a cocktail in our hand, and we become authorities on what we heard, but we didn't read. Why don't you shock me by reading a whole book? Every page of it. Then quote correctly when you're quoting. Marcus Garvey in Jamaica would run for public office. He would win once, second time around. The mulatto group that he had attacked so scathingly was waiting for him the second time. He would lose on a technicality. He would find himself in debt. He would go back to his trade as a master printer. He would pay off his debt.
This is Dr. Henry Clark tonight talking about Marcus Garvey and the movement. we can learn from it. Don't forget, we have the seed of Abraham, blessed and highly favored, 708-582-0372. Go to my website, theseedofabraham.com. I'm praying for you and you. We are getting back to Dr. Henry Clark, and this is a book that you need to read to understand where we at now in 2022.
And then he was prepared to go to England. As he boarded the ship going to England, all the reporters gathered around to hear the last words of Marcus Aurelius before he departed. He said, all right, come, let me, I've got something to say. Yes. Listen. And in the silence of that pin, oh, great message, Marcus Garvey said, Jamaica is a ridiculous country. A contradiction to end all contradiction. Marcus Garvey knew something that Jamaicans still don't seem to know. They could have been one of the great island nations of the world. They got so involved with color, caste, and class, they did not become. They got so involved in being those things most unlike themselves. They could not become. What they needed to become is to develop that great potential. It may not be too late. Then again, it may be too late. They have the manpower, they have the educational power, they have the brain power, they have the trained personnel, they've got a good, strong working class, they've got a country with a good basic climate, a lot of greenery everywhere. It generally rains at night, and wake up in the morning, things are green. With a little manipulation, it can grow most of the thing it needs to eat, the things it needs to eat. It don't have to import Kellogg's cornflakes. You can make cornflakes out of Jamaican corn. Use your imagination. Jamaica once made a good grade of furniture. It's now collector's item that you can ever get to. Buy a piece. Jamaican mahogany existed then. They cut it fast until now they have to wait 20 years again. Jamaican mahogany have seven different grains, seven different colors of mahogany. A light mahogany, a dark mahogany, a brownish mahogany. Can you think of making a piece of furniture with all that beautiful design on it? I went to a school in Jamaica where the schoolmaster told me a bed. He said, my grandfather was born on this bed. I was born on the bed. My mother was born on the bed. The bed was so strong you could put a truck on top of the bed and wouldn't even dent it. Good old mahogany. You don't see that kind of wood anymore, and you don't see that kind of craftsmanship anymore because people don't take that amount of time anymore. Now, let me conclude something that has no conclusion because Marcus Garvey is part of a continuum. He was set in motion the thought pattern that would bring African independent nations into being. He was so influenced people in Africa until in Swaziland, an old king thought that his people about to return, began to plant extra crops to feed them when they got there. The concept of Garveyism was that strong. His newspapers were given to different sailors and dropped off at different ports in other parts of the world. Cuba had 27 branches of the Garvey movement, and Cuba with 16 branches in South Africa. I've gone through a lot of the Garvey records. I advise you that you should read Robert Hill's document of the Garvey Papers. The sixth volume is already out. I have up to five right now. The documentation is just absolutely magnificent. One of the great jobs of research done in our time by a black scholar. Now, Robert Hill's notes and Robert Hill's introduction scholarly done for some of his conclusions over the question, but I tell you the one thing you need not doubt, the documents are documents. He couldn't change the document. And when a definitive history of Marcus Garvey is written, and it may not be done in our time, we will have to rely very heavily on the documents that Professor Hill has brought to our attention. This is the greatest collection of documents on Marcus Garvey that has ever been developed and edited. His influence would be so widespread that he would be the major influence in Pan-African Congress, one of the most important, Manchester, England, 1945. Nkrumah, George Padmore, Peter Abrahams, Johnstone Kenyatta, who later became Jomo Kenyatta. People who would later become heads of state in Africa, influenced by the teachings of Marcus Garvey, and who would incorporate the teachings of Marcus Garvey into the structure of that nation. Nkrumah would have a Black Star Square, Black Star Line. Marcus Garvey's influence on Nkrumah was profound. Marcus Garvey's influence on the rest of Africa was equally profound. And had these states not been waylaid, imitating the parliamentary procedure of the West, that's never going to work in Africa, they could have brought great African territorial states into being as against these imitation European nation states that now exist in Africa. Too restrictive for the African character, too restrictive for African culture. The European created the nation state with its tight borders, its selfishness. The African had the territorial state where a multiplicity of culture existed within one border with respect for all. And they did not begin a conflict one to the other until the European came and created that conflict. So-called tribal wars did not start in Africa until the coming of the European. When he would put one against the other in order to conquer both. Every person that came into Africa did Africa a disservice. Earlier today, I was accused of Arab bashing to be on the WNYC. I was saying that the Arab slave trade started 1,000 years before the European slave trade, and that it drained Africa so much time and energy and organization, the Africa did not have the organization and the energy to successfully resist the European slave trade. What Marcus Garvey was saying to us, in essence, is that I will make you a whole people again. I will heal the wounds of this 500 years of oppression. He would ask the question, where are your men of affairs? Where are your captains of industry? Having not found them, he began to try to make them.